7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
Good morning. We have a good show here.
Yes, we do.
Requests from a number of folks that listen to us that wanted to get our take and our update on that Learjet crash, which there is a lot to talk about in that Learjet, and it's still a fair amount of information that has come out. So when they finally get this report out, there's going to be a lot to talk about.
And there's a lot to talk about now, even though we don't have even a preliminary report from the NTSB, because apparently the information we have implies that the pilot made some decisions that might be a bit questionable. But let me get to the details of the aircraft first. This was a Citation S550, manufactured in 1985, and it was operated by what looks like a company owned by the pilot. The PIC was the music manager of one of the passengers on board, and the other four passengers on board were also related to the business they were in. They had taken off from Teterboro Airport at about 11:15 local time in Teterboro. They went to Wichita, refueled there, and made the final leg to San Diego. Now, a couple of things about that. There was fairly bad visibility at the airport in question. There was no active ASOS or other weather information from that airport. So on the way in, the pilot was talking with ATC, getting weather in the vicinity of the airport. And the weather in nearby airports were also similarly bad. Fairly low ceilings, under 500 feet, fairly low visibility. I think they live on the order of a mile for some of those airports. Yet he wanted to go ahead and make an attempt at landing. And he was having a conversation with ATC, sounded fairly calm, sounded like he was unstressed, but the situation was dark, very early in the morning, about 3:47 local time, 6:47 a.m. in East Coast time where they departed from, which calls into question, did this person pull an all-nighter? Did he take off fairly late in his long working day and have a cross-country flight where he's solo IFR flying? And getting back to the accident itself, he descended below the glide slope, hit some power lines short of the runway, and crashed into a neighborhood. Fortunately, no one on the ground was hurt, but unfortunately, everyone aboard the aircraft was killed. And the thing that just comes back to me looking at this is the decisions that were made. The NOTAM for the airport that was active at the time he took off clearly said that the runway lights for the runway he was trying to land on were inoperable. And even if the lights were working, he had descended below the glide slope for whatever reason. The decision altitude for this particular LPV, LMAV approach he was taking was 6073 feet. And the visibility was less than that. So for the airports that were nearby. So think about it. If the surrounding airports have ceilings that were lower than the decision altitude for this approach, and he does not have the weather for the runway, it seems to me that it's a high-risk maneuver to sort of cross your fingers and think the weather is going to be, and the visibility and the ceiling is going to be better at the runway, and you do a missed approach after that. But unfortunately, They were below glide slope, hit power lines, which were, I believe, were at 525 MSL, and crashed. And as tragic as this is an opportunity for us to have some lessons from this. And fortunately, one of the few good things about this is we actually have photographs of the inside of the aircraft before they took off from Teterboro. One of the passengers took the picture, put it on his social media. And those of you watching the video version of the show can see the layout of the cockpit. And taking a close look at it, I didn't see any placarded instruments. I didn't see instruments that were not illuminated that should have been illuminated. And from my first glance, I'm by no means an expert at this, there was nothing obviously malfunctioning or inoperative in the portion of the instrument panel we can see. And we have no information on maintenance or the maintenance history of this aircraft, but it is an older aircraft that had some aftermarket additions to allow it to do RNAV approaches like they were trying to do. And unfortunately, it was unsuccessful.
It certainly looks like the cockpit had some upgrades done to it. Too bad they didn't upgrade the computer that was behind the yoke.
This was a very successful business person who apparently has this aircraft owned by a company he owns. And this is a story you've seen all too often in aviation. You have someone who is highly successful at what they're doing. They love aviation. They buy an airplane and they fly it for business purposes and other purposes. We just did a show a few weeks ago about a very prominent surgeon who had most of his family killed with him when they had a approach that went badly in upstate New York. And again, extraordinarily successful person, extraordinarily successful family. He had some experience flying this aircraft, but not really a whole lot of experience flying in the kind of weather that led to, that contributed to the crash in upstate New York. We don't know what kind of experience this pilot had in flying this airplane in this kind of weather. That has not yet come out. But he had owned the airplane for some time.
You know, it's really unfortunate that we see this over and over and over again. You know, and one of the things that you often hear around hangars when you get pilots talking is people having more money than brains. You know, I just shake my head over and over because I preach pre-planning, you know, pre-flight, keep your head on a swivel. I mean, if you plan that flight, from what I've looked on the documents, planning that flight before departure at the airport would have clearly indicated to him that there was weather issues in Southern California.
And even if they were in a hurry to leave from Teterboro, they did stop in Wichita, Kansas for refueling for about 45 minutes. Had he, the pilot, looked at available weather data, assuming the pilot had something like ForeFlight to refer to, he would have seen that there was an AirMet in effect for the area he was trying to fly into. And he didn't have to know how to use ForeFlight to know that he took off at 11:15 p.m. East Coast time. And very likely, there was an hour or so prior to that where they're getting the airplane ready, loading everybody in. He's doing the pre-flight planning. And this is 11 o'clock at night. I'm making an assumption here. This was close to the end of a normal workday for him. And he's doing something that is somewhat stressful, takes a high level of attention to detail, flying a high-performance aircraft. They were at Wichita. They had an opportunity to update their knowledge about what they're flying into. The AirMet hadn't changed. And if the NOTAM on the lights being inoperative was red, that hadn't changed either. And certainly, he didn't have to be an expert weather person to understand that the weather at that time of day, if it's bad now, it's probably going to be bad 3 hours from now before dawn.
It's crazy. I mean, so he made a mistake, disregarded some of his defenses before he even got in the airplane. And then, just by virtue of the routing, because Learjets can't go across the country loaded. So he had to stop for fuel. So he had to plan for that. 45 minutes for a fuel job. Fill it up. Kick the tires. Don't light the fires. Go in and check the weather at your destination. He flew over several airports that he could have gotten into. Over the mountains on the desert side. You know, including in southern Nevada. Most likely were clear, because that's pretty dry air over there, and any moisture that comes over the hill dissipates pretty quickly. he bypassed or overflew places that he could have landed safely. One of the things they do very well in California is light their roads. Did he see the lights and think he had the airport in sight and duck down below the minimums to try to find that? You know, scud running, another common mistake that pilots make. You know, I can just duck down a little bit here. I've lost a few friends that have done that. So it's throwing all the safety nets away. I mean, really, pilot, all the pilots that are out there listening to this, and I know I sound like a broken record, and so don't other people in this business, but we see it all the time. All too often, we see these kinds of mistakes made. Pilots disregard them. And I used a word, two words recently on CNN, willful blindness. There's a wonderful book out. It was written in the aftermath of Enron down in Texas. Everybody saw bankruptcy coming. They all had their retirement program from the company tied up in that stock. And they knew it was in trouble. They did nothing. They left it sit, and the company folded, and everybody lost everything in their retirement plans.
In this case, it's not a group or organizational blindness. This is individual blindness to, we're making assumptions here, to the facts at hand. The facts at hand were plain to see. They're widely available. The weather, whether or not the equipment is not working, and your knowledge of your own self. I mean, did this person routinely make cross-country flights, leaving late at night in single-pilot IFR conditions? I would hope that the NTSB investigation does go into what were the pilot's recent experiences, what were the pilot's total experiences doing this kind of flight. And he had five passengers on board who were in his professional community. I don't know if they were working for him or working with him. At least one of them was. That was the musician who took the pictures we showed earlier. And was there some social pressure to get them there? Where are they going? I mean, going from New York to San Diego, there are plenty of commercial flights leaving all the time. And those commercial flights don't stop over for fuel. So what was the attraction of the people who wanted to ride in this jet as opposed to going on a more convenient and, frankly, a lot cheaper option? And there's some kind of social pressure going on there. I don't know what that is. And the passengers. It's hard to say if the passengers were cooperative in the sense of they knew how to behave themselves inside of an airplane like that, that they weren't being an undue burden or distraction to the pilot, that they weren't having conversations and whatnot when the pilot's trying to listen to air traffic control. And again, single pilot operation is challenging. Single pilot IFR operations are more challenging. Single pilot IFR operations with a plane load of people, not all of whom are aviators, who just might be regular friends or family acting like regular friends and family when they're on the trip. Those add to the burden of decision-making on the part of the pilot. Those change the behavior of the airplane, literally, because maybe he doesn't fly with five passengers all the time. I don't know if they had a lot of excess baggage, but again, that's something that they'll have to look into. And finally, just looking at the data, the aircraft drifted below the glide path. One doesn't have to go on a sermon and talking about this. It's like glide path's there for a reason. They don't randomly put those there. Decision altitude was 673 feet. These power lines were about 520 feet. So it doesn't take much off the glide path, depending on where you are on the glide path, to run into obstacles. And the glide path is there to avoid those obstacles.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
You know, there's a lot of confusion out there around the FAA requirements. Most people don't realize that the FAA requirements are the minimum standard.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's not the best. It's just the minimum.
And that's what we want to see. We don't necessarily say you have to do X, Y, and Z. We just want you to do more than the minimum required of you. Because obviously, the more you do, the better pilot you will be.
Great. And then, how are you received when you try to encourage pilots
to go that extra step or go above and beyond? Are they resistant to it? Do they say, well, you know, I get enough training or I do enough flying, I don't need to do that?
Honestly, the majority of the pilots that we deal with are willing to go that extra mile, or when we tell them their discounts are available, they're already doing.
And if I choose to do that additional training, what do I have to provide to you so that I get credit for that?
You have to just let us know. You give us a call, tell us what you're doing, we'll document it, and we don't need any documentation sent to us.
Great.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
While you were talking about the sequence of failures, I was thinking, in my past, we've done a number of these accidents where musical people, bands, and so on, have been involved in crashes. And one of the things that came out in several of them was the managers of these groups oftentimes get finder's fees for planes, for chartering airplanes. So we long believed in some of those accidents, it was the financial incentives to fly certain airplanes in certain weather that they probably shouldn't have that drove that. And in this case, it looks like maybe the financial interest of the pilot, because he probably was charging these guys to charter his airplane, or at very least, they're paying the expenses. And that may have driven him because he didn't want to have them criticizing him if he didn't take them to destination. So there could be some self-imposed pressure on him to nudge him rather firmly to go into an airport that he never should have. And he said something on ATC about giving it a try. They're not going to babysit you. If you want to go, you go.
And on that note about what the incentives might have been, if I were sitting in the room with the NTSB investigators, I would gently suggest to them, ask questions like, okay, let's look into the ownership of this particular aircraft. And I believe the company that owns it is owned by the pilot in command. Let's look at the requirements for that company. Was it one where they needed to have more revenue? Was it one where they had to perform certain things in order to keep it as a legitimate tax deduction? Let's look at the pilot. Was there a certain competency rating that he had to have, certain number of hours he had to have to be able to keep his instrument rating, for instance, or any other requirement that he as a pilot had to have that was being satisfied by being on that flight? Or if those requirements weren't there, you might decide, you know what? Company's doing well. I don't have to get hours to do currency. Let's just take commercial.
You know, they will look at that. With the number of fatalities here, the NTSB will look at that. It's not going to help the families any, but it's clearly human failure across the board. The Swiss cheese model, they were all lining up. All the defenses that are available to the pilot, he violated every one of them. Failure to do a good pre-planning session before he got to the airport. Maybe he was working and he didn't have time to do a good session before he got to the airport. After the airport, he was there for an hour. Sounds like it was maybe a once over lightly. If he had to get the airplane ready, make sure it was fueled, single guy operation. You know, when you have two pilots, one guy goes out and takes care of the airplane. Then the other person goes inside, takes care of the paperwork. So now he's doing it all. An hour is going to make that a very difficult time restraint on him. So it's right off the bat. He's behind the curve before he gets in the airplane. Fortunately, there was nothing wrong with the airplane, so he could have done a crummy pre-flight, and it wouldn't have mattered because everything seemed to work. The flight went uneventful. He landed well in Kansas City or wherever he landed en route to get fuel. Another opportunity to check the weather at destination and the weather in between. There wasn't much weather in between. Maybe that lulled him to sleep, but the weather clearly was not what it needed to be on the West Coast. But runway lights are out and he's going to land before sunrise. That's a challenge in itself. And so he's made multiple mistakes, some of which he made more than once. And the consequences, you pile up that kind of risk. You know, I talk all the time in school, I talk about risk being a ladder, right? And in this case, the poor planning, up one rung of the ladder, rushed, another rung in the ladder, often flying, gets into his fuel stop, doesn't do it again, another rung on the ladder. You know, when he gets to the airport, He's going to try to see it. Two rungs on a ladder. You keep climbing that ladder, pretty soon you're going to fall off.
So. And given this particular accident, I think this goes straight into a second to last word I was thinking about doing for this. And it's not aimed at the pilot. It's aimed at the people who are flying with the pilot. I'm making the assumption that these were folks who may have flown with him on occasion, or maybe it's the first time flying with him. And they may know a lot about aviation, may know nothing about aviation. But anyone who is an adult getting on an airplane knows something about human nature. If something doesn't look right to you, or smell right to you, or behavior doesn't seem right for the person that you thought you knew at work, it's like, wow, this person's like doing things I wouldn't do. Ask some questions. If you don't like the answer, get off the airplane. You know, there's a whole lot of crazy questions you can ask, like, gee, it's like 11:30 at night. Are you going to be awake when you get to the other side of the country?
Well, you know what? People that do music folks and entertainers that do shows at night, you know, in order to make money, they're jumping from city to city all the time. So they finish their show, book it to the airplane or to the bus, climb on. It's driving or flying all night long. They get off someplace. They go to the hotel, grab some more naps, you know, shower and go do another show. So that sort of event for the entertainers is normal. So when these people got on the airplane, I suspect many of them wanted to just sleep. Of course, in a Learjet with five people on board, five plus the pilot, is that what it was?
It was a five plus the pilot.
All right, so not a lot of room back there. It'll seat nine. But, you know, if you want to stretch out, it's not a lot of room.
And this particular jet was a Citation. It's a little bit bigger in the cabin, but not hugely big. It's nowhere near, like, even a DC-9 or MD-80.
Oh, no, not even a Gulfstream. So it was a little bit crowded. Costs may have been a factor for these guys because the Learjet's a lot more inexpensive to operate than a much, you know, even a little bigger airplane. So I'm sure that that was a factor in with some of this. You know, I didn't see anybody there that was famous, you know, a Taylor Swift type, which would draw big money. So these were working musicians that probably were not getting astronomical fees for their services. So you pile all of that on. There's just so many places that something could have been different, you know, with the Swiss cheese lined up, every single one of them.
And now it's time for the last word.
Right. And the last word is very pertinent this time. Pre-plan your damn flight. Do it before you get to the airport. Do it again at the airport. Pay attention to the weather, where you are, where you're going, and everything in between. We do that for a reason, because we've crashed. Hundreds of airplanes have been lost with their passengers by not doing that. And get in your airplane, do a good pre-flight. When you get in the air, put your head on the swivel and don't leave fatigued as the pilot. I'm sure this guy was with these entertainers all evening long, waiting in the wings, managing their whatever it is they had to do, then hauling them all off to the airport. So most likely he was tired getting in the airplane. You don't make good decisions when you're tired, when you're that fatigued. And just flying across the country at night's fatiguing, even if you're just sitting there. And bad decisions, he made plenty of them. So please, please, don't follow these bad habits, this track. Please, do what you've been trained to do. Pay attention. Don't take unnecessary risks. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
According to Avemco claims data, 34% of aircraft accidents happen on landing. Does this number surprise you? Avemco Insurance Company values safety and believes strongly in continuous pilot training and education to help prevent these accidents and promote safer skies for everyone. That's why they sponsor the Fast Team Wings program and the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Avemco rewards safer pilots with premium credits through their Safety Rewards program. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're one of our listeners. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety.